today on Against the Grain. What happened to prisons when the COVID pandemic hit? Why did so many people die behind bars? And why were so many folks on the outside affected and afflicted? I'm CS. Hadar Aviram sheds light on California's COVID-19 correctional disaster coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. A lot that could have happened didn't. A lot that state and prison authorities could have done, they did not do. The result, according to Hadar Aviram and Chad Gertsen, was California's worst ever medical catastrophe in a carceral setting. They lay out what happened and why and what must be done before the next pandemic in a new book titled Fester, Carceral Permeability and California's COVID-19 Correctional Disaster. Hadar Aviram is a professor at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. At our behest, Hadar prepared a talk about the book, which was followed by a Q&A. Here is Hadar's talk.
Imagine yourself inside a cell. You don't know how you got there or how long it's been. In fact, you have no memories at all. But imagining yourself liking it inside the cell, it's a good kind of cell for you. Unbeknownst to you, you are very lucky indeed to be in that particular cell. It's an epithelial cell inside a nose. This nose, part of a human being, is aboard a bus going through a gate. You don't know what any of these things mean. You're a virus. And like all viruses, you know just one thing. How to enter an epithelial cell, hijack its internal machinery, make hundreds of copies of yourself, move on to other cells, and repeat. And here you've hit the jackpot. This is a fantastic opportunity for you, as you will soon find out. It's getting cramped inside your cell. You've been multiplying like crazy in here. Pop! You and your band of brothers burst the cell's outer membrane and spread out. A timely sneeze sends you all flying out into the air like a multitude of tiny parachutists. You don't have much time left to exist as the droplet you're in is rapidly evaporating. Riding the air currents, you come across another human body. You brace yourself. This part would be terrifying if you were the sort that could be terrified. Here come the first defense lines, marching forth to trap and expel you, some of them in possession of intelligence about your predecessors. But your kind are not powerless. You can deceive and manipulate your way past the enemy's defenses. The spoils of this combat are magnificent. You can't tell, but a human would know that you've passed through a wrought iron gate that reads, California State Prison, San Quentin, Ron Davis Warden. Only they can tell whether the host whose nose you were in, whose cells you luxuriated in, was wearing a khaki uniform or prison blues. They are so close to each other. Just a little leap, just a short conversation, or even a few hours on a tray slid into a prison cell. You don't care, do you, whether these cramped rooms bear memories of a petty offense or a serious one, whether this host might someday be injected with a lethal chemical, whether other humans will rejoice or tear up when they hear of his demise. What matters is this: you're staying, because the hosts aren't going anywhere, and you're in the vicinity of so much potential. Your odds of finding a new host are good. Potential hosts are confined together in overcrowded buildings, always indoors where you will not be assaulted by the sun's rays. They're always close together, they sleep in the same rooms, they eat meals together in large halls. Here's an inadvertent hand on the back, or perhaps a fight just broke out. Or the khaki uniforms are manhandling the prison blues. No gloves, no masks, no barriers, no big leaps to make. The world is your oyster. Behold, more hosts! New ones, ones you haven't seen before. Such variety, a revolving door of faces, noses, mouths, lungs. Some of them so worn from years behind bars that they are no match for your feet. You can already tell you're gonna thrive here. You or others can stay here. You could head out on a host, stop while she gets takeout on the way home, sneak back in with someone else. The feet step in, the cars roll through the gates. Sometimes the thermometer they use to detect your presence is broken. Sometimes no questions are asked. Sometimes cursory answers are offered. You can't read the penal code. You can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. You don't care about who's violent and who's nonviolent. There is so much to do here. So many places to be. It's a smorgasbord of opportunity. If you're listening to this and you are not a virus, and you were to come to San Quentin, your experience would be very different from the experience of a virus. The first thing that you would see would be the big tower, you would see the big gates, you would see the fence, and what would immediately come to mind is that the prison is very, very different on the inside than it is on the outside. This is a big part of the way that we are all used and conditioned to think about prisons. As early as the 1960s, when there was a huge boom in prison research, we started hearing about prison as being a world on its own, a world that is separate from the outside. You may have heard about Irving Goffman, who wrote a famous book called Asylum in the early 1960s. Goffman wrote about the fact that prisons are total institutions, places where your whole life is being run in a completely different way to somebody else's clock. Your whole life is prescribed and organized under a set of rules, and it's very, very different than what happens on the outside. And there was a whole boom of writings about this, about the prison subculture, about the economy inside, about how people pass the time, about how the interactions between the guards and the prisons go. And we got used to thinking about prisons as being this separate place. But it turns out that this idea that prison is insulated and impermeable is just not true. Every day, in every prison and every jail, everywhere in the country and in other countries as well, people and things come in and out every day. Hundreds, thousands of staff members come in and out of their workplace every day. Visitors come in. Lawyers come in, volunteers come in, they go out. People get transferred between facilities. They move from jails to prisons, from prisons to other prisons, from prisons to immigration detention facilities. Supplies get being brought into prison. The boundary is a lot more porous than we imagine. In our book Fester, Chad Gertsen and I talk about the COVID-19 crisis in California prisons. This is the worst medical disaster that has happened in the history of the whole state. And we maintain that a big part of why this happened, why the outbreaks were so serious, why they claimed so many lives inside, and why they claimed so many lives on the outside, has a lot to do with how much people buy into this myth of prison impermeability. The basic thesis of our book is that the idea of prison impermeability is responsible for the notion that if you shut prisons down, if you quarantine them, then nothing is going to happen on the outside, that you can separate prisons from the outside and you can somehow isolate them. Moreover, we argue that prison impermeability goes hand in hand with this animus on the outside that consists of fear and loathing of incarcerated people. And this idea is some kind of zero-sum game. The idea that if you somehow improve prison conditions or care about what life is like for people behind bars, it somehow comes at the expense of the people on the outside. This mentality is 100% wrong, because it turns out that when you treat people in prison as if they're separate from people on the outside, you forget that whatever happens with prison conditions on the inside also affects everything that happens on the outside. This mentality is responsible for afflicting with serious disease not only the people behind bars, but also you and yours. And as we show in Fester, had the COVID outbreaks in prisons been properly contained, 12,000 fewer Californians on the outside would have died of COVID. The way we go about doing this is by talking a little bit about how we arrived at the COVID moment with prisons that were not prepared to properly deal with this calamity and without the proper ideology and the proper mentality to really provide appropriate sanitation and healthcare. We talk a lot about the suffering in prisons, and we talk about it through the reports of incarcerated people themselves bringing to you their own voices unmediated by us. We also bring some information about the resulting suffering in jails and about how a mentality in which the sheriffs didn't want to report what was going on led to very serious outbreaks that flew completely under the radar of journalism, of statisticians, and of public health officials. We talk about what an uphill battle it was to guarantee vaccination behind bars, to get vaccine acceptance, and mostly to get prison guards to accept the vaccine. And then we talk about the coalition that fought very, very hard to get good healthcare and prevention behind prison. And we talk about the litigation efforts to try and save old and sick people behind bars, as well as you and yours, by extension, from getting sick. Let's start by talking a little bit about the background to the crisis. You may have heard that in 1919, there was a very serious flu epidemic in California. It was known as the Spanish flu. During those years, the Spanish flu somehow got into San Quentin, and Stanley, the prison physician, wrote a piece for a medical journal in which he wrote about how quickly the disease spread throughout the prison. If you read it, it's just as if somebody wrote last year a medical article about what happened with COVID, because not much changed between 1919 and what's happening now. Health conditions remained abysmal in all prisons, and they became even worse as prisons became more and more overcrowded. This was not the case in all facilities, but generally speaking, the whole system was very overcrowded. It's just that some facilities also had a physical plant that was so decrepit that it was impossible to provide proper sanitation and proper isolation. This is the special case of San Quentin Prison in Marin County, which used to be, you may not know this, used to be a ship. In the 19th century, convicts in San Quentin were kept on a ship, and it is the convicts that lived there that were told to build the prison on land. The people that are housed today in San Quentin largely live in buildings that date back to the 1850s construction of this land prison after they transferred them from the ship. And since then, we don't have solid bars there and we don't have proper ventilation or sanitation. As the prison population grew and became huge in the 80s and 90s, there were serious concerns about the possibility of providing proper healthcare. And litigation started in the 1990s trying to make sure that people can get mental health care under these conditions. We arrive in the beginning of the 2000s with prisons that are already stuffed to 200% capacity, which means there are twice as many people behind bars as the facility is designed to hold. There is a complete chaos with administration, with the pharmacy, takes months to see a doctor. People have to receive group therapy for mental health in little cages because it's not safe to get them out. Every time there's a lockdown in the prison, nobody gets appointments, and people's conditions continue to deteriorate out of neglect to the point that every 6 days, a person dies behind bars in California from a completely preventable condition.
That's Hadar Aviram talking about Fester, Carceral Permeability and California's COVID-19 Correctional Disaster, which he co-authored with Chad Gertzen. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Hadar Aviram teaches at the University of California, College of the Law, San Francisco. We go back now to more of Hadar's talk.
After many, many years of litigation, a three-judge federal panel finally establishes that the thing that's keeping us from giving people proper health care is the fact that the prisons are just extremely overcrowded. And after much ado and many, many efforts to reform the system, which included taking the healthcare system out of the hands of the state and giving it to a federal receiver, they finally issue an order to decrease the population in California prisons from 200% of design capacity to 137.5. Why 137.5, you might ask? Not because this is some kind of magical number, but because they figured out this is the smallest number that we can expect the state to reasonably be able to do it. So this case gets appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ends up actually approving this order, and the state begins to take steps to try and reduce the population, which they finally succeed in doing only around 2015, after Prop 47 passes and allows for further decarcerations. This litigation, which is known as Brown versus Plata, is widely regarded as this massive victory for incarcerated people, for human rights, and massively known as the great experiment of decarceration in California. But when you actually look at what the prisons looked like after Plata, you can see that there are already some problems in place, some of which the Plata litigation exacerbated instead of alleviating. The first one, and that's important to state, is that even under the Plata mandate, prisons are still horrendously overcrowded, and in some facilities, more than 150%, because the litigation only required the whole system to reduce population. They didn't order decrowding of every facility separately. In addition to that, A big part of how they accomplished the decarceration was by shifting a lot of people out of the prisons and into the jails. But that means that now the jails are getting overcrowded. And now the question becomes, are we going to have one big health crisis in the prison system, or are we going to have 58 separate health crises in each and every county? All of these things together bring us to a moment where we have to start preparing for the possibility that the pandemic is going to get into this very overcrowded and congregated space, and nobody is doing the homework that they should, thinking about maybe there are hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people that are behind bars that don't necessarily need to be there. And this is despite warnings from the CDC, from the WHO, and from numerous experts in prison healthcare. And by the way, this was not the first time that the prison system has had to deal with post-Plata problems having to do with overcrowding. Valley fever at this point was ravaging prisons in the Central Valley, and the prison system was unable to provide consistent solutions because of this denial mentality that they were in, and because of this inability to think about decarceration in a serious way. And that's how we get to the COVID moment: unprepared, overcrowded, and without having done any serious thinking about how to deal with it. At this point, we turn to first-person accounts of people who experienced COVID behind bars in the years 2020 to 2023. These are being collected by a project at UC Irvine called Prison Pandemic, where people called in and people sent letters where they describe what happened to them. And that's how we get a sense of the fact that the suffering in prisons during COVID didn't have to do just with COVID alone, but with a whole assortment of ancillary issues related to COVID and stemming not just from COVID, but also from the COVID lockdown condition. The first thing we have to talk about is how the outbreaks even happened. So we know that at least in one case, in the San Quentin case, the outbreak comes from the fact that there was a botched transfer of 200 people out of Chino prison who were moved to San Quentin and to Corcoran. For about a month before the transfer was supposed to be happened, these people were not tested for COVID, and it was not known whether they were positive or negative as the transfer was getting ready to happen. On the day of the transfer, several people reported to the nurses that they were feeling symptoms. They were feeling feverish, they were coughing, and the nurses said that they were just malingering and they should get on the bus. And they proceed to drive these people on the bus, packed up like sardines, for 11 hours until they drop them off in the prison. And then they promptly mix them up with the population that was already in the prison. As these people get integrated into the prison in Marin County, word of this comes to the health officials in Marin County, and they write a letter to San Quentin saying, we're worried about COVID, we're worried that COVID's going to get out of San Quentin, it's going to infect people in Marin County, please take precautions, please isolate these people, we are here to help. And the top medical official of Marin County receives a letter from San Quentin that says, you're a county official, we're a state facility, we don't have to do what you're telling us, and they just completely ignore it. Promptly, these people are tested positive, and they proceed to infect everybody else in the prison. San Quentin becomes absolutely ravaged to the point that more than 75% of the prison population becomes sick, and several dozen people die. In other facilities, the way the outbreaks happened was through the vectors of transmission, which were the people who come in and out of the facility. And I refer, of course, to correctional officers, people who go home and then go back in. At that point, the California Office of the Inspector General did some studies during the pandemic to try to figure out how it is that people were able to bring the pandemic into the prisons. And it turned out that the screening procedures at the entrance to the prison simply didn't work. Thermometers were broken, questions weren't being asked, people were allowed to self-test without reporting the results, the testing was voluntary, and because of that, a lot of people who didn't even know that they had COVID because they were asymptomatic would come to work carrying the virus and, of course, proceed to infect the people on the inside. Once people were already infected on the inside, we got reports from people that medical treatment was really rotten and neglectful. This is not because the doctors were sadistic or didn't care about people. This is because we're coming to this moment of COVID already with numerous vacancies in the healthcare mechanism in California. We're already experiencing a situation where they don't have enough doctors, they don't have enough nurses, especially in the facilities that are remote or rural, and people just have to wait and wait and don't receive any treatment beyond just checking their vitals once or twice a day. The way that they try to deal with the fact that they now have a bunch of people that are positive and a bunch of people that they're negative can only be described as playing Tetris with human lives. They start moving people around, housing them with other people, trying to house positive people with positive people, even though at that point they already knew that COVID is not a thing where you're either sick or you're healthy. You can get sicker if you're in the room with another person who's positive. So people are breathing on each other, they're coughing on each other, and literally there is no physical space to put 6 feet between each two people. In addition to all this, they start putting people on the outside. Eventually, they realize there's no way we can put them anywhere, and they're being scolded by the doctors for housing people in their administrative segregation cells. And then people don't want to report that they have COVID, and so we don't get reporting, we don't get people willing to get checked, willing to get tested. To try to deal with that, eventually they decide to start building tents on the outside. And this becomes the perfect storm because this is the summer where we have serious fires in California. And so we have people who are elderly, who have chronic lung issues, being housed on the outside, breathing this ashen air and becoming even sicker from being housed on the outside. All of this stuff basically grinds the entire prison administration into paralysis. And they start being unable to provide people with basic services. And what do I mean by that? First of all, in addition to the problems with COVID healthcare, there are also people who have other healthcare issues, not just COVID. So all of that healthcare just stops to a grinding halt. And this is especially true in the special cases involving old and infirm people, people who are in wheelchairs, people who don't have access to care, so all of that gets neglected. Because of all of the housing paraphernalia and mess, they end up housing trans people with people that they would not put them in the cell with just because of the danger of violence. And we're seeing all kinds of problems with death row housing as well. The breakdown in basic functions also means that there's no functioning laundry, so people have to try while they're sick to launder their own sheets and their own clothes. And the kitchen also stops working because a lot of the people who work in the kitchen become sick. And that means that you can't actually provide people with enough calories to keep body and soul together. We have emails between correctional officers reporting that they're unable to put together a meal that has the requisite number of calories for people at this point. And, of course, as a result of all this, a lot of people who are in lockdown, especially folks that were already experiencing various mental health issues, anguish, anxiety, depression, all of these situations just become deteriorated, and this becomes a huge mental health crisis in addition to the physical care crisis. When the panic finally settles, a lot of the prisons put everybody under absolute lockdown. Now, remember, these are the early days of the pandemic. We still don't know how you can get infected and how not. So in some prisons, they just deny people completely access to the public phones. So that means people cannot touch the phones. There's concern that people might infect each other using the phone. But the implication of this is that people do not speak with their families for weeks, that people cannot speak to their lawyers and cannot speak to the litigation team that's trying to help them and report what's going on the inside. Or to get proper information about what's happening outside, what the case rates are like, what the vaccine advancement is like. And this creates an environment that is ripe for fear-mongering and for rumors and for all kinds of bad things that happen when people who don't have the right information or haven't educated themselves, and I'm talking including, of course, about the staff, start spreading rumors about the vaccine being dangerous and about what's happening on the outside that lead people to make poor decisions about their own health. In addition to that, we've had people report truly dehumanizing relationships with the staff inside while they're convalescing from COVID, while they're taking to be hospitalized, and even horrendous communication with families and with friends around people's deaths from COVID. We have reports at this point from the San Francisco Chronicle. This is the team that broke the story about the botched transfer. We have stories about family members who found out that their loved ones have died from COVID because they got a letter from the prison asking them to pay $900 for the cremation. That's how they heard that their loved ones had died. All of this suffering also results in adjacent suffering in county jails. And the thing is that if we know a little bit about what happens in prisons, because the prison administration put together a database that reported about cases, about vaccinations, about deaths, we didn't have nearly as much good information about the jails. At some point in August, the Board of State and Community Corrections, which is responsible for coordinating between the state and the sheriffs in the various counties, issues the letters to the sheriffs asking them to report about COVID cases. But the sheriffs respond in a non-uniform way. In some cases, you actually get information about what's happening. In some cases, the only way you hear about outbreaks involving hundreds of patients is through newspaper exposés in local newspapers. The sheriffs do pretty much whatever they want. There's no report on cases. And moreover, it's extremely difficult to get any sort of solidarity or any sort of agreement between the jail population and itself, actually, to get vaccinated or to take certain steps, because jail populations are a lot more transitional. And there are a lot more people stuck in jail because at some point the prison shuts down the transfers from jail, trying to prevent their own outbreaks, creating a bottleneck of people in the jail.
That's the voice of Hadar Aviram, spelled H-A-D-A-R, A-V-I-R-A-M. She is a writer and a professor at UC Law SF. We've put a link on againstthegrain.org to the book Hadar and Chad Gertsen wrote titled Fester, Carceral Permeability and California's COVID-19 Correctional Disaster. It's published by University of California Press. Hadar's other books include Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment, and Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We return now to the remainder of Hadar's talk about Fester.
And then there's a new hope, because in the winter of 2020-2021, the vaccine finally emerges. And the first thing that we get told once the vaccine gets developed by the California Department of Public Health is that the priority is going to be given to people who are in congregated spaces, meaning schools, meaning nursing homes. But does that mean prisons and jails? Turns out, not necessarily. And at that point, the advocates for the prison population embark on a huge battle to try and get the vaccine allocated to people in jail. And what we have to battle here is this public ideology or mentality of the zero-sum game, of the idea that there's a limited number of vaccines, and if people in prison who supposedly don't deserve, as much healthcare as people outside of prison get them, that means that somebody's grandma is not going to be in line to get the vaccine. So this is a complete misunderstanding of the fact that prisons are actually at this point super spreading events. They're incubators with thousands of cases of COVID in them. And if you don't vaccinate the people inside, of course, guards are going to take the disease with them on the outside, right? But it's a huge uphill battle to get the Department of Public Health to understand this. Prisons are prioritized and then deprioritized. And while all of this is going on, we're also deeply worried about whether people are even going to accept the vaccine. Because at that point, the fear-mongering, the bad treatment, the misinformation, the dehumanization were already in place for so many months that we figured CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, has probably lost so much credibility that it's going to be very difficult to persuade people that the vaccine is actually good for them. But much to our pleasant surprise, and the credit to this goes primarily to the incarcerated people themselves, people do agree to take the vaccine in large numbers. And in fact, the percentage of vaccinated people in California prisons exceeds the percentage in the general population. A big part of this is also the work of formerly incarcerated people who record short videos encouraging their friends to take the vaccine, videos that you can watch on a smuggled cell phone so that you get information from somebody that you're absolutely sure has your best interest in mind. Who doesn't take the vaccine? The correctional staff. Correctional staff, the acceptance rate hovers around a little bit more than 50%, and you're seeing huge antagonism to the idea of getting the vaccine. And it's not entirely clear what's going on. How much of this is the political capture of the prison guards union? How much of this is COVID denialism among the staff? And I should say this in itself is kind of difficult to stomach, given that 50 of their friends had died of COVID while this was going on. And nevertheless, this becomes a huge thorny issue, and it plays out in the prison litigation as well. And this is a good segue to what we did with litigation. So there were two main efforts at litigating while COVID was going on. One of them is a case called Von Steitsch, which dealt just with what was happening in St. Quentin. And the other one is a case called Plata versus Newsom, which dealt with what happened, generally speaking, in the prison system. So early on in the pandemic, as the huge outbreak in St. Quentin started happening, with the help of Legal Services for Prisoner and Children and the Prison Advocacy Network, people start filing habeas corpus writs from behind bars. And at some point, there are about 300 of these floating around, and the court in Marin, the Superior Court in Marin, consolidates these into a habeas case, where basically people are saying, I'm being held here in conditions that are cruel and unusual, that violate the Eighth Amendment, I need to be let out. The standard to find an Eighth Amendment violation constitutionally is called deliberate indifference. You have to find that prison administration knew that people were facing very serious health risk and yet treated that risk with deliberate indifference. And all of these cases get kind of stuck in Superior Court. One of these cases, on behalf of a man called Ivan von Steitsch, gets denied very, very quickly. And the team from the First District Appellate Project manages to appeal this case to the Court of Appeal. And they're very happy that they did it because they hear that Justice Anthony Klein, is going to sit on the case. And he's known to be somebody who has a lot of compassion and care about prison conditions. And at that point, we start thinking, maybe this is what we need to do. Maybe we need to get a decree of decarceration using this von Steitsch case. A little bit about von Steitsch, who is not super typical, but it's not a rare situation what happens in that case. We're talking about a 64-year-old person who's been incarcerated since the 80s and who has chronic lung conditions dating back many, many decades. This person is being held in a cell for 23 hours a day with another person who is also COVID positive, and they proceed to just cough at each other for days on end. We appeal this case and we come before the Court of Appeals and we make the argument that we have a serious situation here that requires intervention. What the Attorney General says at that hearing is, there's no proof that that's the case. We have to have a factual hearing. We have to have evidence being provided, despite the fact that the other party doesn't provide any evidence that people are safe behind bars. The Court of Appeal finds for the prisoners and says, we find that indeed there is an Eighth Amendment violation here. We do have to do something and we have to do it quickly. So we are charging the prison authorities with reducing the population in St. Quentin by 50%, and we don't care how they do it, by releasing people or by transferring people. This essentially gives the prison administration a gift, because what they say is, we're not going to release anybody. What we're going to do is transfer you guys to other prisons. This is a huge blow for a lot of the people in St. Quentin, because St. Quentin is pretty much the only place in the CDCR system that still offers people a serious array of rehabilitative programming that they need to make parole. And moreover, a lot of these people fear that if they get transferred somewhere else, somewhere rural and remote, not only are they never going to see their families on a regular basis, but also they're going to find themselves in situations of animosity. People will resent them from coming from the COVID prison, right? And so they refuse the transfer. And then the Attorney General says, well, you can't have it both ways. You want to be safe from COVID, we'll transfer you. You don't want to transfer, you have to stay in St. Quentin. And then they also appeal the case to the California Supreme Court. The case gets thrown back into Superior Court for an evidentiary hearing. And at that point, we have a Zoom trial that lasts a few weeks with people testifying from behind bars about what happened to them. Consistently, the Attorney General lawyers are interrogating each and every one of those people, asking them if they got vaccinated, because at this point, the vaccine was already available. What are they trying to do? If the person got vaccinated, they're going to say the prison discharged its obligations. The person is sufficiently protected from COVID. And if the person isn't vaccinated, they're going to say it's this person's fault that they're facing medical risk. Eventually, the judge at that hearing finds that the Eighth Amendment has been violated, and that people did face deliberate indifference to their health. However, they don't get any remedy, because the finding is that the vaccine changed the game and now people are sufficiently protected. At the time that this decision is issued, which is November of 2021, we already have a scenario where the Omicron variant is on the rise and there's not a single prison that doesn't have an outbreak. But while all of this is going on, there's a second case that's making it through the courts, and that's Plata versus Newsom. So this is essentially an effort to resuscitate the Plata litigation about healthcare and make it about COVID. The judge that's in charge of that case, Judge John Tiger, who is an expert on complex litigation, tries to do things by consensus. He said, I don't want to force them to release people. I just want to come to some solution. He begs the governor to consider releasing people. He says that his pleas for all of that stuff are falling on deaf ears. And in several meetings that the court is holding, these kinds of case management conferences, he actually shows slides with pictures of people, both correctional officers and incarcerated people who died of COVID, and visibly teary-eyed, he expresses how sad he is about all this. But he feels that because of the Prison Litigation Act, his hands are tied, there's nothing he can do, and there's no solution except by consensus. Except nothing is going to go by consensus, because at this point, even though the vaccine becomes available, and even though the demands of the incarcerated people are a lot more modest, all they want is for the guards to get vaccinated so that they're safe. He says, I don't know if I can force them. Let's see if we can try to persuade them. Let's see if we can try to talk to them. But it really doesn't go anywhere. Finally, even Judge Tiger runs out of patience. And in October, he issues an order that requires that the guards get vaccinated. And the guards immediately appeal this decision with full support from Governor Newsom and from the Attorney General, Rob Bonta. And here is why the governor and the attorney general support this. This may sound a little bit weird, because these are, after all, the California officials who kept saying that we're a science-forward state, right? And that we care about vaccines and we believe in vaccines. So why do we believe in vaccines for schools and we don't believe in vaccines for prison guards? The answer is that the concern was that if we required prison guards to get vaccinated and they would refuse and quit their jobs, then we wouldn't have enough people to take care of the prisoners. The answer to that, of course, is that if we cannot recruit enough people to do this job and care about the people that they're taking care of, then perhaps we shouldn't be incarcerating so many people. But it turns out that the appellate court agrees with this kind of reasoning. The Ninth Circuit says this is fine, they can't get vaccinated, and this is how we lose the federal case as well. Part of the conclusion that I draw from all this is that courts are a terrible place to get solutions for these kinds of emergency situations. And that what we need to do right now, before the next pandemic comes in to decimate prisons and creep onto the outside to our cities and towns, is to decrease the prison population for 50%. We have got to let go of this zero-sum mentality. And we've got to realize that people in their 60s, in their 70s, in their 80s sometimes, are safer for us when they're in the community, when they're families, than when they're incubating a dangerous disease behind bars. This is just one of several recommendations that we make in Fester of things that we can do right now to change this situation before the next pandemic hits and it becomes too late.
That's Hadar Aviram, professor at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco, talking about her and Chad Gertson's new book. It's called Fester, Carceral Permeability and California's COVID-19 Correctional Disaster. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We are now joined by Hadar for some Q&A about the book. Hadar, in your talk, you tie 12,000 COVID deaths in California. These are deaths outside prison, to COVID outbreaks within prison. What evidence supports this causal link that you're making?
So one of the challenges that we have when we try to figure out how disease in prison affects the outside is that there was such chaos in the prisons that nobody was doing any sort of case tracing. That means we have to rely on epidemiological models. And the model we're relying on is a very well-known model in epidemiology. It's called the Bradford Hill criteria. And essentially what we're doing is we're looking at various parameters that can explain correlations. First of all, we're looking at the way that outbreaks peak in prisons compared to how they peak in the population surrounding the prisons. For that purpose, we broke the counties in California into three groups: counties that have a prison within them or in close proximity, counties that are neighboring counties with prisons, and counties that are very remote. Now, you would expect that areas in California that have a higher urban density are also going to have more COVID in them. But it turns out that the rural counties that are characterized by a very high number of incarcerated people or by a high number of CDCR institutions are the ones where we're seeing the peaks. And the peaks typically follow by a few days after the peaks in prison. So that's one thing that we have. Another thing that we have is super spreader events. So many of us probably remember the data about super spreader events and about the fact that they tend to account for the bulk of infections. And super spreader events in prisons, on average in California, affected 1,000 people. Of course, there were much bigger ones, like the one in Quentin and in other places. The highest number following the super spreader events in California was in nursing homes, and it was 80. So the main super spreader events that happened within California were prison super spreader events. The next thing that we have is something that we call a counterfactual. So let me explain a little bit how this works. Suppose that we're in a ranch in the American West, and there's a little spark of fire that falls into the ranch. And suppose that the ranch has grassland, but it also has a pile of dry wood, right? If the spark falls on the dry wood, there's going to be a huge fire right away, and then it'll spread to the grassland. If it falls on the grassland, there's going to be a little bit of fire, and gradually it's going to spread to the wood, right? The problem is that either way, the ranch ends up engulfed in flames, and we're not going to know which started it, right? Did it start in the prison? Did it start on the outside? There is a way for us to gauge this, and we basically create a rings model where we have three concentric rings. The inner ring is the prison, the ring around it is the neighboring county, and the ring on the outside is the more remote counties. We can, using statistical tools, remove the impact of the prison to see if the impact on the other rings is the same. And this is what we did for San Quentin and Marin County, finding that if you remove the outbreak of San Quentin, meaning in real life, if the outbreak in San Quentin had been properly controlled, you get 59 fewer deaths in Marin County outside of the prison. So those are 59 people who didn't have to die and died because the outbreak in prison was not well managed. And overall in California, if we're looking at the effect of all the prisons, we're hitting a number that's just a little bit shy of 12,000.
And CDCR, again, is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and CDCR facilities are state prisons, right?
Correct.
California Governor Gavin Newsom makes a number of appearances in your book, Fester. You alluded to one of them in your talk. Another involves a prison release plan, a sort of emergency release plan issued by Newsom's administration in July 2020. What did that release plan mandate, and how would you evaluate it, and what sort of impact did it have?
I'm really glad you asked, because that's actually one of the biggest tragedies in the story that we tell in Fester. The courts wouldn't be able to act immediately, but the governor could. The governor has the authority to do emergency releases, to release people through commutations and through parole, and there would have been mechanisms that would have allowed us to get old and sick people out in time to save their lives. Here's what happened. In July, we held a press conference in front of the prison in which we invited and called Governor Newsom to visit the prison and see what was going on. Just a day later, they announced a release plan, and they said that they were going to release 8,000 people. 8,000 people out of 100,000, when there's not room to put 3 feet, let alone 6 feet between people, was a drop in the bucket. It was nothing. And when you look at the actual details, which got published actually in the Chronicle a few months after, you can see who they released and why it didn't help. Because there's this constant fear of the political blowback from releasing people who are doing lengthy sentences for serious crimes, what they did was release the low-hanging fruit, the people that would be more palatable from a political perspective releasing. Basically, what they did was they did a little push out the door for the people who had just a few weeks left on their sentence. And that was the bulk of the people that were released out of those, I think it was eventually 7,400, if you look at the end numbers. Very few of them were people over 60, very few of them were even people over 50 or 55, and very few of them were people who had legitimate medical complaints. Here's where the problem is. Usually, when people get old in prison, it's because they've been in prison for a very long time. And how do people get to serve long sentences in prison? When they're sentenced for a very violent crime. So we get a situation where the people that are least appetizing from a political optics perspective to release because they're doing time for serious crimes are people whose crimes happened 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago and who have aged behind bars. This means two things about this population, and this is all based on robust criminological knowledge. The first is that these people have already aged out of crime. All of our crime statistics and all of the things that we know about life course criminology tell us that people tend to age out of violent street crime in their mid to late 20s, which means people in their 50s now pose less risk to public safety than people on the outside. The other thing that's important to point out is that the same people, because they've spent so long in prison and because prison is so brutal on the body, now also suffer a variety of chronic conditions. They have respiratory issues because the prison is filthy and it's not ventilated. They have a variety of issues with their blood pressure, cardiac concerns, a lot of mental health issues, of course, but also serious physical health conditions for which they're not getting great health care for all the reasons that we explain in Fester, which means that they're already arriving at the moment of the pandemic being people who are more susceptible to getting very seriously sick. And that means these would have had to be the people, if we were really thinking about this through a public health prisons, these would be the first people in line that we would have had to let out. Because we are much less endangered by them when they're outside than when they're inside incubating a serious disease. The problem is that optically, if you get a report that somebody who committed a heinous crime, a homicide, something like that 40 years ago is being let out, there's going to be a big public outcry. Because people tend to equate the seriousness of the offense with risk, and they forget that the most important variable is age. And this is why this plan didn't work. It came in too late, it targeted the wrong prisons, and for the most part, it targeted for release the wrong people.
You indicated at the end of your talk the importance of reducing the prison population by 50%. People will wonder how that can be done safely, can be done without, aside from COVID concerns, can be done without making California residents more likely to be victims of crime.
This was one of the recommendations that was very important for us because we think that not only the public health problem, but a lot of other prison problems could be solved if we just had half of the prison population that we have now. And we believe that it can be done safely and without a risk of deterioration in public safety. Here's how we do the math. First of all, consider the fact that about a quarter of the prison population in California consists of people who are 50 years and older. These people are already old in prison standards because you age much faster in prison than you age on the outside. We have a lot of criminological evidence that at this age, people will have aged out of crime and they no longer pose nearly as much of a risk to public safety. Moreover, about half of the population in CDCR facilities are people who CDCR itself admits are low risk. And that is taking into consideration that they are very conservative in risk assessment and that they take into account the severity of the crime. So that means that even people who are doing time for very serious crimes, if 20, 30, 40 years have passed since then, even CDCR does not believe that they are dangerous anymore. A lot of the people who are doing time in women's prisons are not violent. 80% of the women who are incarcerated come from a background of trauma. A lot of these people could be at home with an electronic monitor, and we would be just as safe as we are with these women behind bars. So from a public safety stance, it is possible to do it. Now, we realize, of course, that public safety is not the only consideration, how we incarcerate people, and that there's also an element of retribution, and there's also an element of, you know, giving people what they deserve. But we think that you can factor all of these things in, and you still end up with a prison population that is considerably smaller and safer than the one that we have now.
Beyond calling for reducing the prison population by 50%, what other recommendations do you and Chad Gertsen, again, authors of the book Fester, make in your book?
We have a whole host of propositions. They're addressed to a variety of people, and we think that they can save us from another disaster like this. The first thing that we think is that we can and should elect people who are going to have the courage to act in a situation like this and do the emergency releases that are required. We think that the model of hiring and training correctional officers need to change. And that if we hire people, they need to be people who are worried about the folks that are entrusted to their care, that they care about their health, and that they're willing to do what is necessary, including to accept scientifically validated vaccines. So that's important. The other thing we think is that we can think about ways in which the electoral process can be depoliticized in a way that unions, like the Prison Guards Union, are really going to care about the actual racial interests of their members, who, after all, need somebody to stand up for their safety and for their health, instead of posturing and supporting a variety of punitive legal propositions. So that's another thing, and we think that changing campaign contribution laws can lead to some of that. We also think that conditions on the inside can and should change. We think that there should be a lot more rehabilitative offering, and that is to ensure that people are not clamoring to do time in certain prisons that have more rehabilitative offering, thus leading to more overcrowding and to more problems when something like this happens. And there has to be a safe reentry continuum, because if we are really serious about reducing the prison population, we have to make sure that people have the tools that they need to succeed in having a law-abiding life on the outside. Above all, we have a recommendation for the activists. One of the problems that activists face in these kinds of things is whether we're going to fight for long-term goals or for short-term goals. Once the vaccine came out and we started advocating for people to get vaccinated, some of the activists understandably felt that that was going to reduce the pressure of our long-term demand to release people, because supposedly if you can get vaccinated, then it's not urgent to let you out. And I understand this way of thinking, but it's difficult to insist on this long-term decarceration goal when you can save lives today by insisting that people get vaccinated. So as activists and advocates, we have to have enough love in our heart for both wars, for the long-term war to reduce incarceration in America and for the short-term goal of saving lives today. And above all, it is so important to never lose hope, because these struggles can be so depressing. I can tell you, this was hard. This was a hard fight. This was hard litigation. It was difficult to work in this coalition. We were against terrible odds, and we were hearing about awful suffering on the outside. But every life in the face of a crisis like this is worth saving.
Hadar Aviram, Thomas F. Miller Professor at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco, author with Chad Gertson of FESTER, Carceral Permeability in California's COVID-19 Correctional Disaster, published by the University of California Press. Hadar, thank you for writing, for co-writing this book, and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really hope we can prevent the next one.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.